Chapter 28. Mr. Barkis and Peggotty were a good while in the church, but came out at last, and then we drove away into the country. As we were going along, Mr. Barkis turned to me and said, with a wink, "By the by, I should hardly have thought before that he could wink. What name was it as I rode up in the cart?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, Clara Peggotty, apostrophe," I answered. "What name would it be as I should write up now, if there was a tilt here?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, Clara Peggotty, again?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," I suggested. "Clara Peggotty Barkis." "Apostrophe, apostrophe," he returned, and burst into a roar of laughter that shook the chaise. In a word, they were married, and had gone into the church for no other purpose. Peggotty was resolved that it should be quietly done, and the clerk had given her away, and there had been no witnesses of the ceremony. She was a little confused when Mr. Barkis made this abrupt announcement of their union, and could not hug me enough in token of her unimpaired affection. But she soon became herself again, and said she was very glad it was over. We drove to a little inn in a by road, where we were expected, and where we had a very comfortable dinner, and passed the day with great satisfaction. If Peggotty had been married every day for the last 10 years, she could hardly have been more at her ease about it. It made no sort of difference in her. She was just the same as ever, and went out for a stroll with little Emily and me before tea, while Mr. Barkis philosophically smoked his pipe, and enjoyed himself, I suppose, with the contemplation of his happiness. If so, it sharpened his appetite, for I distinctly call to mind that, although he had eaten a good deal of pork and greens at dinner, and had finished off with a fowl or two, he was obliged to have cold-boiled bacon for tea, and disposed of a large quantity without any emotion. I have often thought, since, what an odd, innocent, out-of-the-way kind of wedding it must have been. We got into the chaise again soon after dark, and drove cozily back, looking up at the stars, and talking about them. I was their chief exponent, and opened Mr. Barkis's mind to an amazing extent. I told him all I knew, but he would have believed anything I might have taken it into my head to impart to him, for he had a profound veneration for my abilities, and informed his wife in my hearing, on that very occasion, that I was a young rhesus, by which I think he meant prodigy. When we had exhausted the subject of the stars, or rather when I had exhausted the mental faculties of Mr. Barkis, little Emily and I made a cloak of an old wrapper, and sat under it for the rest of the journey. Ah, how I loved her! What happiness, I thought, if we were married, and were going away anywhere, to live among the trees and in the fields, never growing older, never growing wiser, children ever, rambling hand in hand through sunshine, and among flowery meadows, laying down our heads on moss at night, in a sweet sleep of purity and peace, and buried by the birds when we were dead. Some such picture, with no real world in it, bright with the light of our innocence, and vague as the stars afar off, was in my mind all the way. I am glad to think there were two such guileless hearts at Peggotty's marriage as little Emily's and mine. I am glad to think the loves and graces took such airy forms in its homely procession. Well, we came to the old boat again in good time at night, and there Mr. and Mrs. Barkis bade us goodbye, and drove away snugly to their own home. I felt then, for the first time, that I had lost Peggotty. I should have gone to bed with a sore heart indeed under any other roof, but that which sheltered little Emily's head. Mr. Peggotty and Ham knew what was in my thoughts as well as I did, and were ready with some supper, and their hospitable faces to drive it away. Little Emily came and sat beside me on the locker for the only time in all that visit, and it was altogether a wonderful close to a wonderful day. It was a night tide, and soon after we went to bed, Mr. Peggotty and Ham went out to fish. I felt very brave at being left alone in the solitary house, the protector of Emily and Mrs. Gummidge, and only wished that a lion or a serpent, or an ill-disposed monster, would make an attack upon us, that I might destroy him, and cover myself with glory. But as nothing of the sort happened to be walking about on the Armagh flats that night, I provided the best substitute I could, by dreaming of dragons until morning. With morning came Peggotty, who called to me, as usual, under my window, as if Mr. Barkis the carrier had been from first to last a dream to. After breakfast she took me to her own home, and a beautiful little home it was. Of all the movables in it, I must have been impressed by a certain old bureau of some dark wood in the parlor. The tile-floored kitchen was the general sitting room, with a retreating top which opened, let down, and became a desk, within which was a large quarto edition of Fox's Book of Martyrs. This precious volume, of which I do not recollect one word, I immediately discovered, and immediately applied myself to. And I never visited the house afterwards, but I kneeled on the chair, opened the casket where this gem was enshrined, spread my arms over the desk, and fell to devouring the book afresh. I was chiefly edified, I am afraid, by the pictures, which were numerous, and represented all kinds of dismal horrors. But the Martyrs and Peggotty's house have been inseparable in my mind ever since, and are now. I took leave of Mr. Peggotty, and Ham, and Mrs. Gummidge, and little Emily, that day, and passed the night at Peggotty's, in a little room in the roof, with the crocodile book on a shelf by the bed's head, which was to be always mine, Peggotty said, and should always be kept for me in exactly the same state. Young or old, Davy dear, as long as I am alive, and have this house over my head, apostrophe said Peggotty, you shall find it, as if I expected you here directly minute. I shall keep it every day, as I used to keep your old little room, my darling, and if you was to go to China, you might think of it as being kept just the same, all the time you were away. Apostrophe, I felt the truth and constancy of my dear old nurse, with all my heart, and thanked her as well as I could. That was not very well, for she spoke to me thus, with her arms round my neck, in the morning, and I was going home in the morning, and I went home in the morning, with herself and Mr. Barkis in the cart. They left me at the gate, not easily or lightly, and it was a strange sight to me to see the cart go on, taking Peggotty away, and leaving me under the old elm trees looking at the house, in which there was no face, to look on mine with love or liking any more. And now I fell into a state of neglect, which I cannot look back upon without compassion. I fell at once into a solitary condition, apart from all friendly notice, apart from the society of all other boys of my own age, apart from all companionship but my own spiritless thoughts, which seems to cast its gloom upon this paper as I write. What would I have given to have been sent to the hardest school that ever was kept? To have been taught something, anyhow, anywhere. No such hope dawned upon me. They disliked me, and they sullenly, sternly, steadily, overlooked me. I think Mr. Murdstone's means were straightened at about this time, but it is little to the purpose. He could not bear me, and in putting me from him he tried, as I believe, to put away the notion that I had any claim upon him and succeeded. I was not actively ill-used. I was not beaten or starved. But the wrong that was done to me had no intervals of relenting, and was done in a systematic, passionless manner. Day after day, week after week, month after month, I was coldly neglected. I wonder sometimes, when I think of it, what they would have done if I had been taken with an illness, whether I should have lain down in my lonely room and languished through it in my usual solitary way, or whether anybody would have helped me out. When Mr. and Miss Murdstone were at home, I took my meals with them. In their absence, I ate and drank by myself. At all times I lounged about the house and neighborhood quite disregarded, except that they were jealous of my making any friends, thinking, perhaps, that if I did, I might complain to someone. For this reason, though Mr. Chillip often asked me to go and see him, he was a widower, having, some years before that, lost a little small light-haired wife, whom I can just remember connecting in my own thoughts with a pale tortoise-shell cat. It was but seldom that I enjoyed the happiness of passing an afternoon in his closet of a surgery, reading some book that was new to me, with the smell of the whole pharmacopoeia coming up my nose, or pounding something in a mortar under his mild directions. For the same reason, added no doubt to the old dislike of her, I was seldom allowed to visit Peggotty. Faithful to her promise, she either came to see me, or met me somewhere near, once every week, and never empty-handed. But many and bitter were the disappointments I had, in being refused permission, to pay a visit to her at her house. Some few times, however, at long intervals, I was allowed to go there, and then I found out that Mr. Barkis was something of a miser, or as Peggotty dutifully expressed it, was a little near, and kept a heap of money in a box under his bed, which he pretended was only full of coats and trousers. In this coffer, his riches hid themselves with such a tenacious modesty, that the smallest installments could only be tempted out by artifice, so that Peggotty had to prepare a long and elaborate scheme, a very gunpowder plot, for every Saturday's expenses. All this time I was so conscious of the waste of any promise I had given, and of my being utterly neglected, that I should have been perfectly miserable, I have no doubt, but for the old books. They were my only comfort, and I was as true to them as they were to me, and read them over and over I don't know how many times more. I now approach a period of my life, which I can never lose the remembrance of, while I remember anything, and the recollection of which has often, without my invocation, come before me like a ghost, and haunted happier times. I had been out, one day, loitering somewhere, in the listless meditative manner that my way of life engendered, when, turning the corner of a lane near our house, I came upon Mr. Murdstone walking with a gentleman. I was confused, and was going by them, when the gentleman cried, "What? Brooks?" Apostrophe, "No, sir, David Copperfield, apostrophe," I said. "Don't tell me. You are Brooks, apostrophe," said the gentleman. "You are Brooks of Sheffield. That's your name, apostrophe." At these words, I observed the gentleman more attentively. His laugh coming to my remembrance too, I knew him to be Mr. Quinion, whom I had gone over to Lowestoft with Mr. Murdstone to see, before it is no matter I need not recall when. "And how do you get on, and where are you being educated, Brooks?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," said Mr. Quinion. He had put his hand upon my shoulder, and turned me about, to walk with him. I did not know what to reply, and glanced dubiously at Mr. Murdstone. "He is at home at present," apostrophe said the latter. "He is not being educated anywhere. I don't know what to do with him. He is a difficult subject," apostrophe. That old, double look was on me for a moment, and then his eyes darkened with a frown, as it turned, in its aversion, elsewhere. "Humph," apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Quinion, looking at us both, I thought. "Fine weather," apostrophe, apostrophe. Silence ensued, and I was considering how I could best disengage my shoulder from his hand, and go away, when he said, "I suppose you are a pretty sharp fellow still, eh, Brooks?" Apostrophe, "I." "He is sharp enough," apostrophe said Mr. Murdstone, impatiently. "You had better let him go. He will not thank you for troubling him." Apostrophe, on this hint, Mr. Quinion released me, and I made the best of my way home. Looking back as I turned into the front garden, I saw Mr. Murdstone leaning against the wicket of the churchyard, and Mr. Quinion talking to him. They were both looking after me, and I felt that they were speaking of me. Mr. Quinion lay at our house that night. After breakfast, the next morning, I had put my chair away, and was going out of the room, when Mr. Murdstone called me back. He then gravely repaired to another table, where his sister sat herself at her desk. Mr. Quinion, with his hands in his pockets, stood looking out of window, and I stood looking at them all. "David," apostrophe said Mr. Murdstone, To the young, this is a world for action, not for moping and droning in. Apostrophe, as you do, apostrophe, added his sister. Jane Murdstone, leave it to me, if you please. I say, David, to the young, this is a world for action, and not for moping and droning in. It is especially so for a young boy of your disposition, which requires a great deal of correcting, and to which no greater service can be done than to force it to conform to the ways of the working world, and to bend it and break it. Apostrophe, for stubbornness won't do here, apostrophe, said his sister, what it wants is to be crushed. And crushed it must be. Shall be too. Apostrophe, he gave her a look, half in remonstrance, half in approval, and went on. I suppose you know, David, that I am not rich. At any rate, you know it now. You have received some considerable education already. Education is costly, and even if it were not, and I could afford it, I am of opinion that it would not be at all advantageous to you to be kept at school. What is before you is a fight with the world, and the sooner you begin it, the better. Apostrophe, I think it occurred to me that I had already begun it, in my poor way. But it occurs to me now, whether or no. You have heard the counting house mentioned sometimes, apostrophe, said Mr. Murdstone. The counting house, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I repeated. Of Murdstone and Grinby, in the wine trade, apostrophe, he replied. I suppose I looked uncertain, for he went on hastily. You have heard the counting house mentioned, or the business, or the cellars, or the wharf, or something about it. Apostrophe, I think I have heard the business mentioned, sir, apostrophe, I said, remembering what I vaguely knew of his and his sister's resources. But I don't know when. Apostrophe, it does not matter when, apostrophe, he returned. Apostrophe, Mr. Quinion manages that business. Apostrophe, I glanced at the latter deferentially as he stood looking out of window. Apostrophe, Mr. Quinion suggests that it gives employment to some other boys, and that he sees no reason why it shouldn't, on the same terms, give employment to you. Apostrophe, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.